Welcome to AFP Audio, and I'm speaking with Simon Brown, who is an emergency physician, Royal Perth Hospital, and professor in emergency medicine at the University of Western Australia in Perth. Welcome, Simon.
Hello, Cass.
We're talking today about your article in the Emergency Care Focus in the June AFP, Anaphylaxis Recognition and Management. Thanks very much for your excellent article. Can we just bring out some of the main points from that article? You start off with talking about causes of anaphylaxis, and you mentioned that medicine, insect venom, and food are quite important. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, I guess there's a rule of four, or a quarter, I suppose. About a quarter of cases are due to medicines, a quarter to venoms, a quarter to food, and a quarter end up being unknown, having an unknown cause as a rough thing. The actual proportion of each depends where you are. So if you're in a country area, then insect venom is going to be a big thing. If you're in a city area dealing with older patients, then medications are the biggest thing. And overall, medications seem to cause the largest number of deaths. That's probably related to the fact that older people are more likely to have medication allergies. And as you get older, you're less able to cope with anaphylaxis, and so the chance of physiological compromise are probably higher, and therefore the risk of death. So that's why you see a disproportionate number of deaths due to medicines in the elderly, where probably more than half of anaphylaxis deaths are due to medications. The other important concept is one of summation anaphylaxis, and that's something which we're just starting to recognise, where for example, someone might be able to eat wheat, bread type products and not have anaphylaxis, but if they do it just before exercising, then the combination of an IgE-mediated sensitivity plus exercise can bring on anaphylaxis, whereas on its own it may not. Now, some practitioners think that you might see the same thing with alcohol, non-steroidals, in addition to other allergens, but look, it's a tricky area to prove, but we can say that, you know, with exercise and some allergens, you can get the summation anaphylaxis. So most exercise-induced anaphylaxis, or a lot of it, is probably more summation anaphylaxis once you identify the allergen that's causing it. It all comes down to history. It's hard to tease out the cause of anaphylaxis because the history that the first person dealing with a case drags out is very important. Often patients forget over time. And you need to, you know, once the patient's responded to treatment, you really do need to sit down and have a chat with them and just carefully go through everything they've done and taken before the reaction they might have. I just saw a case literally last week who came in with a second episode of anaphylaxis, or sorry, it's really more angioedema in this case, but after carefully talking to him, asked about over-the-counter drugs, he said, oh, yeah, I did take an aspirin this morning.
Mm.
And so that, and there was a bit of a delay. Often with non-steroidals, you see this relatively slow onset of a reaction, and he'd probably had it to the aspirin, but they didn't pick up the first time because, you know, he didn't sit down and take the time enough.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily what the patient thinks is the most obvious.
Yeah, that's right. And sometimes it may be two or three presentations, but each time if you're carefully going through everything they've done or ingested over the last 24 hours, you can work out what's going on. We sometimes resort to giving patients food diaries so that they can keep track of everything if they're having recurrent reactions.
Mm. And the pathophysiology of anaphylaxis is pretty dramatic. We also state in the article that some patients or a proportion of patients will actually recover with little or no treatment. Can you explain that?
Yeah, it's interesting. If you go back some decades, some of the early sting challenge studies in Europe, people would be treated just with a bit of intravenous fluid and antihistamines. Now, we know that antihistamines can actually make anaphylaxis worse because they cause vasodilation. Nevertheless, these people were surviving. And we see from time to time people who have insect stings. You know, the farmer driving his tractor gets stung, feels a bit dizzy, lies down for a few hours, he wakes up, it's dark, and then gets up and goes home. And so you do see that a number of people that will have this quite dramatic vasodilation, bradycardia, and a bit of shortness of breath, say collapse. The blood pressure is low for a period of time, but the compensatory mechanisms kick in, and you know, eventually they recover and they're able to get up again.
So I guess
probably won't. Sorry,
it's important in the history to ask about other episodes that people might not have associated with an allergen or an anaphylactic reaction.
Well, people usually know something's gone wrong. It is part of the history. You go back and sometimes people have had reactions without getting medical care. Anaphylaxis has quite a low mortality, probably in the order of about 1% mortality rate. And most of those deaths occur before people reach medical attention. And a number of them are probably contributed to by poor first aid. And the most important thing is making sure someone lies flat. Someone lies flat, they can cope, they get just enough venous return to the heart and they can get through the worst of the reaction. But if you prop them upright and give them a cup of tea, then they'll just get profoundly hypotensive, bradycardic and die.
So in order to start the right treatment, GPs obviously need to recognise what when a patient is undergoing anaphylaxis. It's obvious if it's the typical massive urticarial reaction and hypotension. Are there situations where it's less obvious?
Yeah, you're right. I mean, you see a patient who's just got that widespread urticaria, they're breathless and a bit hypotensive or wheezy, then you can say that combination of multiple organ effects equals anaphylaxis. But we know that in around 20% of cases or so, you may miss the erythema. Some people have this odd idea that massive swelling of the face means anaphylaxis, not that's angioedema. Most life-threatening anaphylaxis, you just get a bit of flushing, mild erythema of the skin, and then they get the more serious organ effects, such as the severe bronchospasm, hypoxemia, and hypotension. And so it's important to realise that you may miss the subtle skin features. And also patients can go directly into profound shock and actually be pale. I remember one case who collapsed in front of us, very pale, and we started up the adrenaline. And then after the adrenaline kicked in and then the blood pressure came back up, then she got this diffuse urticaria once we'd resuscitated her from her cardiovascular collapse.
I guess the urticaria can only happen if there's enough
blood flow. That's right. The important thing to remember is that with a sudden onset of anaphylaxis in the like person, they can get profoundly bradycardic. What seems to happen is that if you get an awake animal and you take blood and you bleed them, up to about 30% of blood volume when it comes off, you'll get a tachycardia. But if you take away more than 30% of the blood volume very quickly, then you get a profound bradycardia and cardiovascular collapse. So the heart just literally slows down, probably to give it time to fill because of such reduced venous return. Now, in anaphylaxis, you can get quite a marked vasodilation, and so you get reduced venous return to the heart. So that same mechanism probably kicks in when they go bradycardic. So you may get a very rapid cardiovascular collapse. And sometimes with asthma or sudden onset asthma, you've got to bear in mind that some anaphylactic reactions present with very little in the way of cardiovascular effects, but with quite profound bronchospasm. And again, later it's a careful history where you pick up the precipitants that have triggered that, remembering that a lot of asthma is IgE mediated. So I think that the key clinically is when you see someone who's got hypotension or hypoxemia with severe bronchospasm, then you've got to think to yourself, is this anaphylaxis? And if there's some doubt and they're not responding well to treatment, I think adrenaline adrenaline works with asthma and adrenaline works with hypotension. But you might as well give adrenaline and consider fluid resuscitation, particularly where they're hypotensive. So treat as anaphylaxis. It'll also cover other potential causes. And then things will become apparent as you get more detail and see how they respond to treatment.
So in addition to adrenaline and lying the patient flat, are there any other treatment modalities that you recommend?
Yeah, the really important things are to lie the patient flat if tolerated. Some patients with very respiratory reactions may have trouble lying flat, but by and large, you can lie someone flat because that'll maximise venous return to the heart. If they're struggling to breathe, then sit them upright, but don't stand them up. So try and maximise venous return with posture. Get the intramuscular adrenaline in. Obtain wide bore intravenous access. If they're hypotensive, start pouring in fluid. So quite large amounts of fluid can be needed, up to an adult. 3 to 5 litres of fluid might be needed in the first 20 to 30 minutes if they're profoundly hypotensive. So they're the keys. You'll find usually that in most cases, if they're laid down, given intramuscular adrenaline, get intravenous access, most people will respond to that first dose of intramuscular adrenaline. If it's given early when there's still reasonable tissue perfusion, it'll get absorbed very quickly, probably even before you can get an IV in. You'll get some adrenaline taken up from the intramuscular dose. And then if they need more adrenaline after 5 minutes or so, you can give another dose of IM adrenaline. And by the time you've assessed their response to that first dose of adrenaline, you can work out whether they need fluid resuscitation as well as further adrenaline.
An assessment of that response, the blood pressure is pretty key to that.
Yeah, that's right. I think a lot of people don't realise how important a simple systolic blood pressure is. If a patient collapses, you can put a blood pressure cuff around their arm, feel their pulse, either radial or brachial, get a very quick idea of systolic blood pressure at the point where the pulse disappears and then reappears again. Let it down a bit further and whammo, you've got a tourniquet. Mm. So you can then use that to get in a wide bore IV, bung it and get ready to give fluids. And then you've got a good accurate BP. One of the problems with some automatic cuffs is they don't always give you an accurate response, and it always is, or accurate reading, it is good to get a manual blood pressure. But in this case, the systolic blood pressure is very important, and it's a good marker of initial severity and will give you a good idea of treatment response. And if you do end up giving lots of adrenaline, it'll help you recognise adrenaline toxicity. There are two main problems with anaphylaxis. Sometimes, occasionally, we don't treat them enough when they need lots of adrenaline, but almost as often, if not more often, you see a medical legal episodes where patients have been given a lot of adrenaline too much intravenously or big doses IM when they probably didn't need it. So it's systolic blood pressure which is going to help guide that treatment.
And intravenous is a no-no unless they're in a cardiac arrest?
Yes. I think some doctors leave their hospital training having done anaesthetic term where a well-meaning anaesthetist has explained to them how to carefully give intravenous adrenaline. And maybe in anaesthetics we get overwhelming responses to rapidly injected antibiotics or paralytics, you may more often than not need to give small IV doses of adrenaline. But for the vast majority of cases in the community, they don't need that IV dose, and you're more likely to cause problems such as hypertensive crises. I've seen VTVF arrests and subarachnoid hemorrhages resulting from excessive intravenous doses of adrenaline. So it's much safer to start with IM, and if you do need to go more than that, an IV infusion is a much safer way to give further adrenaline.
And bolus doses?
Yeah, bolus doses are a no-no. Look, the time, it doesn't take long to get a milligram of adrenaline, put it into a litre bag or whatever bag of fluids you have, a saline, and then give a careful IV infusion. And even if you don't have an infusion pump, it's much safer to drip in a bag of saline with adrenaline in it than to give a bolus.
And will most patients respond reasonably well to one or two doses of
adrenaline? The vast majority. The need for intravenous adrenaline is rare.
Yep.
The vast majority respond to one, sometimes two or three intramuscular doses of adrenaline. The key is if you give adequate fluid resuscitation as well, then you'll help overcome or to reverse the problems that are causing that hypertension.
Mm. And you mentioned that it's a good idea for the patient to be observed for about 4 to 6 hours in the emergency department after they've responded to the treatment, say if they respond in the GP's practice, to get them in the ambulance and get them to emergency. Why is that necessary?
The literature is a bit confusing in that some of the earlier publications suggested that 20 to 30% of people with anaphylaxis would then go on to have a delayed phase reaction. I think they were very highly selected case series. And they don't reflect the truth of the matter. Probably mainly 1 to 3% of all reactions end up having a delayed phase reaction, which is basically what you call a biphasic reaction, where you get an initial complete response to treatment. And then maybe, you know, 4, 6, 8 hours afterwards, then you get a sudden increase in reaction severity again. More common, so that's one issue, and certainly people with hypotensive or hypoxemic reactions, we like to keep them for a fair period of time, sometimes overnight, because of that risk. Because it's been such a severe reaction to start off with, often their response to treatment is slow, and we like to keep an eye on them before they go home. However, more common than that is people you give adrenaline to, and then the adrenaline wears off over the next hour, and then you get a recurrence of symptoms, you need further doses of adrenaline. And the other issue for GPs to be aware of is that you may get an initial response to treatment, but if things then get bad again in 20 or 30 minutes, and then you call an ambulance, then you've missed the window of getting help to come. Mm. So I think, you know, if you've got someone with anaphylaxis, you do all those first things, life flight, adrenaline, fluids, but you call an ambulance at the same time.
Mm.
And then if you need the help, it's there when you need it. You're not calling it when you need it to find it's still 20 minutes away.
Yeah.
And likewise, you might as well have the patient moving towards hospital so that if they need to stay for a longer period of time or the adrenaline wears off and they need further treatment, they're in the appropriate
They're in the right spot.
For that. Yeah, it's about managing risk. Look, a lot of patients, you probably could give adrenaline to, keep them in practice for 2 to 3 hours after the adrenaline and send them home. And you get away with that a fair amount of the time. But I think it's wiser to have them heading towards hospital.
Hmm. I guess it's important to determine after the event what the allergen is. What does an assessment involve? First of all, referral to a clinical immunologist or allergist, I guess.
Yeah, probably the most important thing that allergy clinics will provide is a way of minimising risk of future reactions. And the way that the immunologists or allergists will do that is, first of all, spend a lot of time trying to identify the cause. And it's not as simple as doing an IgE test. A lot of people will have positive IgE tests but not be reactive to those things, and a lot of people won't have positive IgE tests and might need skin tests as well as a serum test, and may also need to have challenge testing, so oral challenge testing. And it can be quite tricky sorting out the history and the relevance of the various test results. So the allergist will work out what's the most likely to the cause of anaphylaxis, and then they can provide advice on how to minimise the risk of exposure to those allergens, and that can be quite tricky with food allergens and some of the potential cross-reactivities. And then there are also issues of education about EpiPen provision, going through action plans and immunotherapy where that's available. So for insect venoms in particular, then venom immunotherapy is a very effective option that greatly reduces the risk of further reactions.
You mentioned the jumper jack ant.
My favourite, the jumping jack ant. And they're particularly prevalent in southeastern Australia. But honeybees, European wasps, paper wasps, there are immunotherapies available for allergies to those Australian-wide. Mm.
And
you can also do it for penicillins too, believe it or not, but it's not often that you need to do that. It's usually the alternate.
Usually you can avoid it.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And what should an anaphylaxis and management plan involve or include?
I think one of the really important things is standardisation. We've moved on, say, about 10, 15 years ago, every hospital allergist, GP would have a different approach to management plans. Often they'd be typewritten for specific patients, and there was a lot of inconsistency in what people were told. Now, these days, I think consistency is important because, particularly with schools, we have education packages to help teachers as well as other paramedical nursing staff in what to do for anaphylaxis. So we need consistency to give people a structure. And the ASCIA, the Australasian Society for Clinical Immunology and Allergy, has developed a number of action plans or preformed action plans that follow a standard structure that explain to patients what to do if they get a reaction. And I'd strongly encourage the use of those in Australia. So www.allergy.org.au, mm-hmm. and there's an anaphylaxis resource section there. So education about how to respond and when to use the adrenaline auto-injector and how to use it.
Really good pictures on how to use it for patients as well.
Yeah. The general practitioner reviews are very important with this too, because often when patients leave the ED, all they remember is they've had an allergic reaction. No matter how much education you give them on how to use an EpiPen, they'll still look at it and say, what the hell is this? They just remember they've had an allergic reaction. Likewise, when they go to an allergist, there may be a lot of discussion trying to work out what the cause is, but they still only leave with maybe a couple of things sort of thinking. It's important every opportunity is taken to just go through and make sure they understand their action plan. And each time they'll go away with a little bit more information and a little bit more understanding of the condition. And it's that education which is important to minimise their chance of further reactions and make sure they do the right thing in the future if they find themselves having a reaction again.
And the opportunity is there, I guess, when people come in and say, I just need a repeat script for my EpiPen, which is a consultation.
That's right. That leads on to that one. Yes. Yes, if someone comes in and asks for an EpiPen, you don't just give them the EpiPen. It's an opportunity to make sure that they understand their allergy and what to do. And don't forget with the EpiPen, it's always worthwhile just double-checking if they use an EpiPen. The other one's the Yanapen. But, for example, the EpiPen, if they put their thumb on the wrong end and ram it into their thigh, they're going to get an injection into the thumb, not into their into their thigh. Mm. And so it's important to make sure that they've got the proper technique, they hold it in the fist and they put it in the right direction.
The right end.
Yeah, and make sure they understand their action plan, because they're likely to be caught without their action plan. So just get to read through it, make sure they understand it. The other really important thing is that when people die from anaphylaxis, it's often not just the anaphylaxis that kills them. It's the fact that they're having problems dealing with the reaction because of their comorbidities. So asthma, chronic obstructive airway disease, various cardiovascular diseases, underlying angina, all those things need to be dealt with. So it's important that in someone with anaphylaxis, any cardiovascular or respiratory disease has to be optimally controlled, and that will give them more chance, I suppose, of compensating to a reaction long enough to survive it with emergency medical care.
Yep. And a medic alert bracelet can be helpful for some people.
It is, yeah. Medic alert bracelets do two things. For emergency responders, they trigger the thought of anaphylaxis, because often some people may not have seen anaphylaxis before. They may know what to do or be trained what to do, but they may not have seen that many reactions, so the medic alert triggers that. And also, patients sometimes remember, when a patient comes in for emergency medical care, if they've got an altered conscious state or can't quite remember what's happened in the past, it's good to have a medic alert bracelet. Never trust hospital information systems or computerised information systems, because we won't get told about the nature of someone's allergy until they're walking out the door.
Mm.
You can guarantee that all the different information systems aren't linked.
Yeah,
it's just a nightmare. It's got harder and harder.
In the general practice setting, we have a little box for allergies, and there's all sorts of things in there. Some of them are sort of, you know, codeine and someone's vomited or something. So
there's
various different, inverted commas, allergies that people can have, and distinguishing the important ones.
Mm, and then a bracelet's a good trigger, particularly for when patients end up in hospital. It's a good trigger for staff to double-check and make sure they're not getting it. So it's particularly important for drug and food allergies. Less so for insect stings, because it's pretty clear when someone has a sting and has a reaction, but foods and drugs can be administered in the healthcare setting. And so it's good to have that alert bracelet just to remind staff, act as a trigger to be careful.
And just finally, there's some other resources that you've provided for us in the article. One is an online education program at the Australasian Society for Clinical Immunology and Allergy. Which is worth GPs logging onto and having a look at. And the other is the Australian Prescriber Anaphylaxis Wall Chart.
That's been updated just in the last year. And I think any practice that has an emergency trolley, or any practice that gives any kind of medication or diagnostic agent, it's worthwhile having a laminated copy of that chart just sitting on the trolley. It's a very easy step-by-step process. And I think, the management of anaphylaxis sounds simple, and it is simple. It's easy to say that when you've done it quite a few times, but in an emergency, often you do forget key things, and having a very simple chart on the resource trolley, easy to refer to, I think is well worthwhile.
Makes a big difference. Mm. Well, thanks very much for talking to us today, and thanks for your excellent article in the recent AFP.
It's a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thanks.